I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Growing tensions over race, politics, and territory fueled a fire that would eventually be known as World War I. For many Americans, the war was over there until growing disputes in international waters and a fateful telegram led to the inevitable. Today, we remember the United States' entry 100 years ago into the war to end all wars. Join us as we delve into the rich history and significance of the World War I Memorial here in Kansas City. Find out what's planned for the commemoration, the dignitaries and celebrities attending the event, and the work that continues to collect and preserve the artifacts of those who fought, died, and survived the Great War. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Let's be clear, the United States tried mightily for years to remain out of World War I. But as events changed, the U.S. finally changed course, and that decision led to the Allies winning a brutal fight in the war to end all wars. On Thursday, Kansas City will draw the attention of the world as our town plays host to the 100th anniversary commemoration of this country's decision to enter the war. Today, we'll talk about what's planned and what to expect. Meantime, I should point out that the song you're hearing, Keep the Home Fires Burning, was just one of the many songs that were popular during the long years of World War I. We'll be playing several more this hour, all featuring baritone John Brancy and Peter Dugan on piano. Joining us now is Laura Vogt. She's the curator of education for the National World War I Museum and Memorial based here in Kansas City. And Laura, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. Great to be here.
Well, the United States under President Wilson resisted and resisted and resisted getting into this war. He ran for re-election, in fact, on a campaign slogan of "He kept us out of the war." War in 1916. What changed in 1917?
Oh, great question. And he even worked for peace in December and January. He was successful in creating peace with Mexico, where there had been an expeditionary force led by John J. Pershing left Mexico in February of 1917. But he was unsuccessful in creating a peace in Europe. But in part, it actually goes back to what was happening in North America with Mexico and also what's happening in Europe. By the end of 1916, two of the world's largest battles, the Battle of the Somme and the Battle of Verdun, had ended, and millions of casualties had been incurred on both sides. And with that, the Germans felt that they needed to push ahead. They needed to break that stalemate. So they decided to reinstate unrestricted submarine warfare, in part because over 100,000 in Germany were suffering from starvation and disease because of a very successful British blockade.
Right.
With that, when they decided to do that, they also knew that very likely it would force the United States to go into the war. Unsurprisingly, unrestricted submarine warfare when you're torpedoing U.S. ships, that's not looked upon favorably inside the United States.
So the Germans gambled and they lost.
They did. And there was a foreign minister by the name of Zimmerman who actually sent a telegram via some other countries. The British actually were the first to decrypt it and offered to Mexico that if they were to kind of support Germany, if the United States went into war, that they would help Mexico get its lands back. That's one of the few things I think a lot of folks remember from their American history class back in high school. But it's really not just the Zimmerman telegram. It's really that larger question of unrestricted submarine warfare and how to stop that.
At the end of the day, to what extent did President Wilson have to drag this country into World War I? How willing were we to engage?
We were a divided nation. There are so many things that are similar about
today the and then. Yeah.
Absolutely. You had Teddy Roosevelt, who had been really leading the charge for years that we needed to be prepared, that we needed to be ready, that we needed to be into the fight. You also had an entire faction of folks who were volunteering on both sides. You had the American Red Cross serving both the injured Allies and the injured Central Powered factions. You had ambulance service workers. You had flyers. And you had pacifists who were adamant that we should not be involved in the war. Conscientious objectors who were trying to keep us away from that.
So the president had a push right up until the last minute, it sounds like.
Well, there was actually a meeting on March 20th, and it was very unique.
1917,
absolutely, where he pulled together his cabinet, and his cabinet at that point unanimously provided the advice that the United States should go to war. And it is because of those sinking ships and that very quick turning of the tide of the American public between January and March of 1917.
Well, I've got to ask, we're commemorating the 100th anniversary of the entrance into this war. So why is the National World War I Museum and Memorial based here, as we're talking about a war that took place overseas?
Right. Really, it's because of Kansasitians. It's Kansasitians who came together 2 weeks after the armistice was signed, and they wanted to create a memorial for those who had lived through and those who had died during the war. And in a matter of 10 days, they raised $2.5 million.
And back in those days, $2.5 million was a lot of money.
Absolutely. It's about $34 million today. And it's amazing. It's over about 80% of the population of the greater Kansas City area rallied to support and this beautiful public monument to this moment.
Night long since you went away, I think about you all through the day. My body, nobody quite so
We're talking about tomorrow's celebration of America's fateful decision in 1917 to enter World War I. There's a huge commemoration of that event on Thursday at the National World War I Museum and Memorial. I'm visiting again with Laura Vogt. She's the museum's curator of education. And Laura, we were talking about the construction of the memorial, how Kansas Citians rallied. Just in 10 days, they contributed $2.5 million back in those days to build this memorial. It's such an unusual structure in that it's so tall and cylindrical. What do we know about its construction and how difficult it was?
So it was started in 1921 at the dedication of the memorial. We had five of the Supreme Allied leaders here at the dedication of the space, at, you know, in the heart of our nation, and they'd never been in the same space before. And from 1921 through 1926, there was a tremendous construction effort with Indiana limestone to make this 217-foot tall Liberty Memorial Tower, which you can stop in.
That's a stone that was used from Indiana?
It was. It's a beautiful stone. And while, you know, as listeners kind of head back towards the grounds and you're running when it's not quite so rainy, take a look at it. You can actually see this beautiful variation in color. And that was it was very intentional so that you'd have kind of this warm, kind of warm line that would draw your eye vertical, which is part of that kind of a memorial construction at that 1920s era. You'll also see some beautiful Italian mosaics that also have a color variation that kind of changes your eye goes upward in the two original exterior buildings, Exhibit Hall and Memory Hall, where we now host our rotating exhibitions.
How long did it take to build this thing?
Surprisingly, it only took 5 years, and in my personal calculation, you know, you have a national memorial that was built and opened and funded, most importantly, in less than 10 years from when President Woodrow Wilson declared that the world must be made safe for democracy, and really expanded upon these very virtuous ideals as to why we were sending men to war. It was such a thing that, you know, Woodrow Wilson actually put his head on his desk and sobbed afterwards, so destroyed by the fact that people would clap for that.
Oh, that's interesting. So Kansas Cityans obviously felt very strongly about the war effort and commemorating it here. So much enthusiasm here in town for getting this thing done.
Absolutely. In 1926, Calvin Coolidge came and spoke to the largest crowd any president had spoken to up until that date.
Wow.
Then in the 1990s, just like any aging building, it needed some refurbishment, and Kansas City came together again. And thanks to the support of the city of Kansas City and Missouri and the United States, there was over $102 million that was raised for not only the restoration, but the expansion into the space that it is now, where, you know, 2004, you've got the designation as the National Museum, 2006, a designation as a National Historic Landmark, one of, I think, 40 in the state of Missouri, and then again that affirmation by Congress that we are the we are a national memorial to the World War, and we're the only museum solely dedicated to World War I in the United States.
You know, it's so interesting to me. This is obviously 2017. You wonder to what extent the nation and the world will be interested in all this when 2117 rolls around 100 years from now.
I would hope a great deal, but I will echo actually the words that are on the the front of the Great Frieze. If you walk to the North Lawn between Union Station and the Memorial, and you look up, you'll see there's this really beautiful low base relief, and at the top of it, it says, "These have dared bear torches of sacrifice and service. Their bodies return to dust, but their work liveth forevermore." Looking at the past, but there's this call out to us right now, because that's what a memorial is all about. It's not necessarily about the past. It's about the future. It's about us, present. And the second sentence is, "Let us strive on to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
Yeah, beautiful line. Where did the idea for this commemoration coming up tomorrow come from? Whose idea was it, and how did all this happen?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, you've got this wonderful support within Kansas City, and you had a convergence, not only this rise of support in Kansas City, but across the nation. You had a variety of folks who were looking to this moment, and a commission was created with the support of many of our local political leaders, and including Emmanuel Cleaver, who will be here at the ceremony tomorrow, to create the United States World War I Centennial Commission, which is producing tomorrow's ceremony.
You know, some people might say that tomorrow we're going to see a lot of glamour, we're going to see a lot of pageantry, Laura, and that's going to be in stark contrast to what this war really was like, that the museum displays in so many ways so effectively, the trenches and what that's like. Am I right about that?
I've had the opportunity to work with some amazing folks, including the artistic director, Ed Billis, out of Juilliard, and they have used some of our photographs and videos, so it will be balanced with the actual images of what was occurring at that time.
Because to call this war brutal isn't really doing it justice.
No, no.
Yeah.
I wish one could know them, I wish there were tokens to tell the fortunate fellows that now you can never discern. And then one could talk with them friendly and wish them farewell and watch them depart on the way that they will not return.
That's John Brantsey singing with Peter Dugan on piano. They'll be part of tomorrow's ceremony at the World War I Memorial. These songs and more will be on their album, A Silent Night, a World War I Memorial in Song, set for release on April 28th. I'm visiting here with Laura Vogt. She's the education curator at the National World War I Museum and Memorial. Kansas City is the site of that big international commemoration tomorrow of the U.S. entrance into the war 100 years ago. So, Laura, what's going to be happening tomorrow during the ceremony? When does it begin? What are we going to be seeing?
Well, tickets are already sold out. So unfortunately, if you don't have a ticket, you won't necessarily be able to join us on site, but we would love for you to join us online. We'll be live streaming at www.theworldwar.org/April 6th, or just remember theworldwar.org, and you can easily get to it from there. At 9 a.m., we will begin with some beautiful music and the like. There will be some comments from politicians, from dignitaries, from some of the folks who really helped make this happen. And then at 10:45, the ceremony will begin, and we will have a wonderful flyover by the Patrouille de France, which will begin the ceremony itself.
Those things always grab me.
Oh, they do. And it's a very poignant and appropriate start, because Europe had already been fighting this war for three years.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then throughout, we'll have participation from the U.S. 1st Infantry Division Band. They actually have a historic color guard that will be coming in World War I appropriate attire, along with a Native American color guard, Army, Air Force. We'll actually have representation from all of our armed forces.
Who are some of the best-known speakers who will be here? I know the president was invited, but he's not going to be here.
That is, I have yet to hear confirmation about
that. You probably know
about
it by
that.
Now.
You would think we might know it by now. But we do have the secretary, I do know for certain, the secretary of the Army will be there. And we'll be speaking some of the words of folks from 1917. Most of this ceremony is really built around the words of those who lived through and those who died during the war, which seems the most appropriate way to commemorate this moment, this time when we were trying to decide who we were going to be as a nation, and all of these different voices that intertwined to make it happen. Because that is very much who we still are today.
This French flyover, everyone's going to hear that, even if you're not at the ceremony. This won't be a secret to anybody, right? If you hear loud thunder booming tomorrow, it may not be the weather. It may be airplanes and jets scooting over.
It might be. There's also going to be a B-2. So if you hear that, and hopefully do, think of us at the National World War I Museum and Memorial, or look out your windows, because it will be magnificent.
What other activities are taking place here as part of this commemoration?
So later on, the ceremony itself will be going from 10:45 to 12:30. We are excited not only for our American participation, but also for the international participants who will be speaking at the ceremony itself. Of course, some amazing artists, including those from the Kansas City Symphony and the Lyric Opera, who are going to be contributing their talents. And then at 2:30 in the afternoon, via live stream, folks can become a part of a colloquium that we'll be hosting that includes notable folks like journalist David Ignatius and the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission Chairman Robert D'Alessandro, hosting some conversations about important questions that still impact us today, like, should the United States have entered the war? How do we build peace after a great conflict?
And the really good news is it's not supposed to rain tomorrow.
It is not. We've been saying since October it's going to be 54 and sunny, and I think that's going to happen.
What special exhibitions are currently on display during this big commemoration here?
So we have actually just opened a new one that everyone can see. It's out 24 hours a day. It's a beautiful new photographic exhibition showcasing the photojournalism of Mike Scheel, who is out of the United Kingdom. It is Fields of Battle, Lands of Peace, The Doughboys, 1917 to 1918. And not only did it open in the Memorial Courtyard here in Kansas City, but on April 6th, it's actually opening at Guildhall Yard in the City of London.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So these are photographs taken back in the day.
It's a combination of both, actually. So we have photographs from our collection that then show and support these really beautiful color photographs of what those battlefields look like today. It is worth seeing. I believe the exhibition ends kind of towards the end of the summer, so be sure to stop by. But it's wonderful to see that not only is the nation coming, not only is the world coming to Kansas City during the time of the centennial, but Kansas City is taking its global collection and its stories out to the rest of the world.
Just guessing here, Laura, that the staff is maybe a little pooped right about now.
You know, there have been four new exhibitions that have gone up this year, not only Fields of Battle, Lands of Peace, but Vive l'Amérique, which is this really beautiful look at French children's art and what they thought of the U.S. doughboys coming into their city.
I'll take this as a yes.
Yes.
If people are pooped.
They are.
Yeah. That's baritone John Brancy and Peter Dugan on piano as we commemorate the 100th anniversary of America's fateful entrance into World War I, again, 100 years ago. I'm visiting with Laura Voigt. She's the museum's curator of education for our final segment today as Kansas City gears up for this huge commemoration tomorrow of this 100th anniversary of our entrance into the war. What work is still going on, Laura, at the museum to collect and preserve and display the artifacts from the Great War? And are you guys still coming up with new stuff?
Oh, my goodness. Every week. It's amazing.
Really?
Absolutely. The new things that... Well, right, new. New things.
New
to
things
us.
To the museum,
right,
but not new to
us
the world. Yeah.
That come to the museum. You know, we have some amazing Russian artifacts in our new exhibition, Revolutions 1917, that opens tomorrow that are... indescribable. They're really absolutely phenomenal.
Where does the museum come up with new things even 100 years after the U.S. entrance?
Well, people would be surprised. I think it's over 90, I think it's over 95% of the collection is donated.
Sure.
And we're a nation of immigrants. And so, you know, because of that, we have the most global collection of World War artifacts in the world. On good authority from Hugh Strawn, he says that we are the museum that tells the most global story, that we tell it in its kind of truest sense.
Do you guys ever pay for items that might show up in the museum?
Well, that would be a great question for somebody who handles the money. They send
Which
me to work with the.
You,
it's
I
not.
Guess, yeah.
It's not. They send me to work with the breathers.
Yeah. Are there things still out there that the museum really wants to get its hands on that you're aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are always looking for artifacts that talk about or share the African American story, the Hispanic story, Native American materials. Also, anything having to deal with women's work within the First World War. People tend to think that women were just on the home front, and yet, from doctors to actually being Navy yeomen. They had a wide variety of different roles. Submarine materials, we mentioned that at the beginning part of the segment as well. So we're always looking for new things, and we're always happy to help folks who are trying to find out more about their World War I connection at our Edward Jones Research Center.
I imagine you guys get letters fairly regularly then from people all over the world saying, hey, I came across this in some trunk in the attic, and would you guys be interested in having it?
We do. It is really surprising. And as people kind of downsize or shift or move, not only are we happy to, on the right occasion, bring things into our collection, but we're also happy to help people kind of understand what the thing is that they have. Because if what they're holding is part of their personal connection to World War One, that in and of itself, that bit of holding on to history is priceless.
What other museums around the world commemorate World War One? Are there other celebrations or other commemorations going on in Europe and even elsewhere?
Absolutely. We've got some wonderful partners at the Imperial War Museum, in Peronne, really throughout the world. And there will be, again, people from five different continents here in Kansas City tomorrow participating in these commemorations as well. The commemoration for the globe really happens from 2014 through 2019. Mm-hmm. And at the museum, we've really been looking at that global centennial.
So 2019 will be the next big one, then, it sounds like, when the war ended 100 years previously.
Right. So it's officially November 11th of 2018 when the armistice is signed, and then a treaty is signed in Paris in 2019 that Woodrow Wilson has a fairly directive hand in as he talks about his 14 points and the like. But it's a global commemoration, and we're really appreciative that the U.S. Centennial Commission chose to host the only national moment right here in Kansas City.
In the future of the memorial, Laura, what needs to happen to keep this place relevant as the years continue to pass?
I think part of it is people slowing down and just taking a breath and realizing just the relevance of history. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you start to think about that, you can't help but see how this modern era is shaped by the World War. You know, it's the most influential moment of modern history. I would say that you can't look at any front page and not see that. If you look at Syria or chemical warfare or the like, that all kind of finds its roots back there. But if I may just say a thank you, not only to the staff, as you mentioned, who are probably very tired, but also to everybody in this community. Yeah. It is their achievements and it's their support that made it happen.
Laura Vogt from the National World War I Museum, thanks so much for being here. Good luck tomorrow on the big day.
Steve, thank you so very much.